Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I take what you pay, but I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I take what you pay, but I got to put you down for a while.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Top Men Boxing Radio. I'm Patrick Connor of the Fight City. With me, as always, today, James Foley of Bad Left Hook, veritable Chicago boxing icon. Icon. James, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How about you?
Doing good, man. I'm feeling this Premier Boxing Champion surge they got going. Think they're going to continue it? There's no way. Not going to happen.
But how, with Darrell Rubio on tap this weekend, I would say yes.
Going to have to see if we'll agree with that later on in the show. But
guaranteed war.
Yeah, it should be a bloodbath, needless to say. I'm pretty excited about it. But, oh, Jesus, man. Let's jump right in. A highly entertaining... But on ESPN this past Saturday from Staples Center in L.A., a matchup many, including us, hoped would really deliver on the action, wound up doing just that, but Leo Santa Cruz won a majority decision over Abner Mattis, and there's already talk of a rematch. It sounds like both fighters want it. I don't know how much they actually truly want it, but that's kind of the, that's what's being fed anyway. Probably did well, but nonetheless, it's, yeah, I don't know. It was good. But also on that card, the co-feature was Julio Ceja versus Hugo Ruiz. Ceja wound up getting up from a knockdown to stop him in the fifth round. That was a great opener. And the same night across town at the Forum, Shane Mosley rematched Ricardo Mayorga, who looked to be in the cruiserweight range on fight night. It was kind of strange. Definitely a sad version of Mayorga in there. We'll get to Shane later. This weekend on CBS, as you mentioned, Anthony Durrell. That's Anthony Durrell, not Andre Durrell. I don't know that it really makes a huge difference, but he headlines another PBC card against Marco Antonio Rubio. And before you ask, nobody knows why. In the opener, Jamie McDonald gives Tomoki Kameda a rematch, which should at least be solid, if not good. And on Sky Sports, Josh Warrington will fight Joel Brunker. That's it. That's literally it.
Nice.
So there are other some, you know, there's updates around the world, but really not a whole lot. So, yeah.
A lot of action.
In straight away. Yeah, well, let's dig right into what we had in the shit that we had this last weekend, and that's Leo Santa Cruz stepping up against Abner Mattis. And we came to the consensus last week. I think it's pretty clear that Mattis was Santa Cruz's best opponent to date, and in the eyes of most, he took a clear decision. So first, you know, we said it last week in regard to Glavatsky hook, but we have to say it again for this card. Well done, Premier Boxing Champions. It's not as if the winning formula, two Mexicans in front of an LA crowd, was a complicated one, but they implemented it, you know, perfectly, and over 13,000 people showed up. So, you know, I have to admit, I do think it was a little bit sloppy, but it was an intense fight, and both guys really wanted to come forward and, you know, physically dominate. And the story of the fight, or at least what made the biggest difference, was Santa Cruz's jab. When he used it, he got separation and did much better. I mean, where are you on the general consensus here?
I'm in the general consensus. Part of that, because I agree with, you know, pretty much everything you said. I think that the you know, the formula is pretty simple. Make 50-50 fights and, you know, real meaningful fights with high stakes, and good things can happen. You know, and that's, I think, what we saw on Saturday is that, you know, Mares came out and really, you know, tried to put pressure on Santa Cruz early, and he really made it into a great, you know, a good fight, borderline great fight. And Santa Cruz was forced to, you know, raise his game because it was the best opponent he'd ever fought. And I thought he looked, you know, better than he has in 2 years. And I think that, you know, I agree with what you said, that it was kind of a sloppy fight. It wasn't like, you know, a great fight. There were a lot of real wild exchanges, but not much landing that clean. either way. And Santa Cruz did kind of take over in the second half and pretty much rode that steadily till the end. So it was kind of missing that component of real drama in terms of just the outcome, you know, being undecided until the final bell. Because I thought by the eighth or ninth round, Santa Cruz was basically on cruise control. Okay, nope.
Boom.
Sorry about that.
Boom.
But it was a really, really good, compelling, entertaining fight, and I think most of the PBC fights that have been these type of 50-50 fights, which, you know, have probably been the minority of the fights they put on, but most of those have actually been pretty good and pretty interesting to watch, you know, Andre Durrell against DeGale, I thought it was fairly exciting. And, you know, even the fights like Danny Garcia, Lamont Peterson, and Adrian Broner, Sean Porter, you know, they weren't great fights, but there was a consistently compelling, I guess, in the sense that, you know, there was real meaning and real uncertainty about it going into it. And, you know, that's what we want to see from them. They have such a big stable of fighters. There's no reason why we can't get stuff like this consistently, you know. And, overall, I mean, I got to give it, you know, a big thumbs up. I mean, I think it was, you know, by far it was in terms of just the combination of it being a really good fight and as well as featuring two kind of top-level guys. I mean, it kind of does, Saturday night stood out over the last couple months of this in the sport, which have been, you know, not a whole lot going on.
Yeah, and, you know, we said it last week in regards to Glavatsky Hook, but, I mean, it was kind of like, well, if that's the best we got on this year, if that's the kind of fight of the year contender, then that also, it was a good fight, but it also shows that the rest of the year has been fairly weak. But still, even without that context, it was a good card. It, you know, Saturday night on ESPN, especially because it was on ESPN, and what's the word, James? Free? Squeal it. Free.
Free if you have cable,
yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. Free if you're paying $180, $210 a month, you know, whatever, but free.
Yeah, you're right, though. I mean, because ESPN is a channel that, you know, almost everyone has, and guys are just hanging out or whatever and having some drinks, you tend to kind of flip through, and that's one of the go-tos is what's on ESPN, you know. So I think with ESPN, with, you know, the whole deal on PBC, it is a real opportunity to you know, maybe make some new fans of the sport, and a fight like this that featured two really good young fighters, you know, at the kind of top of their division in front of a real, you know, lively crowd is the kind of thing that can make some new fans. It's not stuff like, you know, Paul Malignaggi against anybody, or, you know, Louis Collazo against Keith Thurman,
<Yeah.
laughs> you know, I mean, and so, I mean, hopefully this is a blueprint that going forward, they can, you know, take all the positive reception that this got and try to build off of that by making more competitive fights.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And well, how about our guy, Teddy, just absolutely insisting on calling Leo Santa Cruz Cruz. Like, he just wouldn't get away from,
yeah,
he wouldn't call
great.
Him Leo. He wouldn't call
him
Santa.
Santa's his middle name.
Yeah.
I believe.
Named after Saint Nick. But, yeah, he would not get away from the Cruz. I mean, it's Teddy. He's allowed to. That's okay. But, yeah, it was definitely, I'm not going to, like, call anybody out, because I see various people saying different things. Everybody's got a different opinion and everything like that. But I just kind of, you know, I have a tough time just kind of sitting there and seeing people say things like, oh, that was a total, like, tough man contest. It was like a total amateur fight. And I'm like, well, you know, yeah, nobody in there is going to be mistaking this for, like, Pernell Whitaker versus Buddy McGirt 2. Or something like that, just a really high-level technical contest. Nobody's dumb, you know. A lot of people are dumb. But we know that this is not, you know, this is not pound-for-pound level boxing or whatever, and that's not what the appeal to this fight was. That's not what the appeal to Golovkin, you know, Golovkin-Lemieux is. When we went into this fight, we were like, okay, it's two young guys in the parlance of our times, you know, just going in there, colliding, being physical. We knew that that was probably what was going to happen. So I just kind of have a tough time seeing people say, ah, you know, the skill level was real low in it. How could people like watching that? Well, a lot of people liked watching that.
Yeah,
it was a big crowd, and the people enjoyed it.
And the truth is probably somewhere in between, because there was another side that maybe was going too overboard with the hyperbole and, oh, it's fight of the year and it's so great, you know. I mean, it started off, I thought, really good, but I think some of the criticisms are valid. I mean, there was times where it was a little bit sloppy and there was, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of you know, Mara's attack. I mean, I think he was doing ultimately what we had here, I think, was two really good, you know, young guys with a lot at stake, and they both kind of fought the best of their abilities to get a big win. And I mean, wouldn't you rather see Mara's running forward, throwing combinations, most of which were kind of ineffective, than for him to have tried to take a more cautious tact and maybe try to box moving backward and that kind of thing, you know? So I like to see the two guys go after it. And you're right. I mean, you weren't seeing, you know, like the most elite level. I mean, it wasn't like Guillermo Rigondeau versus, you know, you weren't seeing a lot of that. It wasn't like necessarily great boxing. And there wasn't, you know, the crisp, clean punching that even brawls like the, you know, Barrera Morales, you know, there was such great clean punching that you were really seeing, you know, a war, but also boxing on its highest level, you know. And here, yeah, that wasn't there, but for what it was still very good and very entertaining to watch. And I think a really significant win for Santa Cruz to kind of maybe, you know, get rid of some of the doubters and show. I mean, this was the first, in my mind, kind of the first real live opponent that he's been in there with.
Yeah, and I mean, also going into the fight, there was some talk from him. I had seen in some interviews him saying stuff like, I don't know why people are questioning my opponents, it's not going to matter. Well, I mean, in some ways he was right, because it didn't wind up mattering. He wound up going in there and performing well and doing better than a lot of people anticipated. But, yeah, there was that mark kind of going in. And also, coming out of the fight, it kind of makes me wonder, like, what they're going to do in terms of opponents, because looking at the PBC roster, looking in the PBC stable, I mean, it sounds like Leo Santa Cruz is not keen on dropping weight, and pretty much the only guy I see that's, you know, on a upper echelon, apart from Abner Mattis also, is Gary Russell Jr. So what are they going to do?
Yeah, and Frampton maybe going up to 126.
Yeah, but, that's a possibility.
Those are pretty good opponents. You know, I mean, you can't, I don't know. We have to wait and see, but you're right. I mean, as part of me skeptical and thinking that, like, now we're going to see, you know, both guys in, like, basically, like, tune-up fights, and then maybe, like, a year from now we'll get a significant fight. I hope not. You know, I mean, I hope they go right into trying to make Santa Cruz against Russell Jr., which I think would be an awesome fight. It actually might favor Russell Jr. But, you know, like, there are good fights to be made. They just have to keep on making them. I mean, and I think it's fair to expect, as long as guys are only going to be on TV, you know, twice a year, three times a year, every 4 months, that's enough time to take a legitimate fight. So, I mean, I hear you, because, yeah, you know, it'd be easy to be like, well, he just got his biggest win of his career, so now we'll give him an easier fight, and then all the bullshit about, like, well, you know, he hasn't really been at featherweight too long, we got to take a couple, you know, get him acclimated to the division kind of thing.
And that's the concern,
the usual
is
excuses,
that they're going to,
yeah,
you know, pump the brakes, and it's like, well, capitalize on the hot win, man.
Right. Ride the momentum. But, you know, but it also reminds me the whole weight thing that, you know, I think, again, a big factor in this fight was the size differential, you know, and I think Cruz's frame, his height, and his reach were really, you know, Mara's was just having a really tough time closing that gap, especially, you know, after, like, the fourth or fifth round. And, you know, I do wonder what Mara's real best fighting weight is. You know, I'd like to see him in the mix at featherweight with all those guys. I think he's a good fighter. And I think the idea that, you know, Santa Cruz just dominated him and was just proved that he was on another level, and that's the unimpeachable truth, you know. I mean, that's 36 minutes. And, you know, for the first fight, yeah, Santa Cruz absolutely got the better of it. But I don't really like to, like, I think, so, like, I'm not that opposed to a rematch myself, just because I think, you know, I think in general, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You know, if it's a 50-50 kind of fight and one guy gets the better of it, I say let the other guy have a chance to avenge himself, you know, and it was entertaining, so I don't see what the problem is. I mean, just because there's a decisive winner doesn't mean that there's no reason to ever have a rematch. You know, in the case where there's like a big favorite going into it and everything plays according to script and the favorite, you know, then of course you're not going to demand a rematch to a fight like that. But something that's entertaining, that was kind of a toss-up going into it and that there was a lot at stake, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily have a problem with it. And like I was saying, I think Mahrez is a really good fighter, but I do think maybe, you know, should he be at 122? I think that might be kind of the ceiling for where he should be. And if Santa Cruz is intent on going to 126, then maybe, you know, they take different paths. But I just thought that the size difference, I mean, Mahrez is listed at 5'4.5", you know?
Yeah. And I mean,
pretty small for that division. Probably average height's probably around 5'7", 5'8" at featherweight.
I think that's actually a really valid point. I mean, they don't. It wasn't such a huge size. It wasn't such a huge overall size difference that when they were in the ring, they looked like they were in, you know, vastly different weight classes or something like that. But it was clear enough, like I said, you know, starting out, that when Leo Santa Cruz started using his jab, Abner Mahdi's, like, he like didn't even really know what to do to get around it. He was just kind of, you know, flinging shots, and sometimes it worked, a lot of the time it didn't. So that's a significant problem against anybody at featherweight who's going to be, you know, a decent size. And we have to remember also Santa Cruz just came up from 122. It's not like he's a guy that's been at featherweight for a long time and, you know, has been kind of bulking up there or sitting there ready to move up or something like that. So I do think that that could prove to be an issue against a lot of opponents for Abner Mahdi.
Yeah, especially considering the style, you know, that he fight. I mean, I don't think he has that weapon or that one, you know, single weapon or some kind of defensive mastery to where he can afford to kind of give up all those kind of physical advantages. But, you know, I mean, I still come away from this thinking both guys are really good. It's kind of a similar thought. Now, I think these two fighters might even be better, but it's a similar, you know, in the older fight that I'm going to reference, but I think it's kind of a similar reaction that I had to Lomachenko against Gary Russell Jr., which is just that, you know, so one guy has to lose a fight like this. I don't think it's necessarily, you know, that the loser's shit and the winner goes on to, you know, all sorts of glory and everything like that.
Yeah, totally.
I just like seeing two, you know, and the same thing with, like, you know, Darrell DeGale or whatever. It's like, I just like seeing two kind of, you know, two guys on the same skill level with a lot to fight for, you know, going out there and doing battle. And I commend, you know, both guys for kind of giving it, you know, and Mahrez, I mean, to me, he made the fight as exciting as it was by choosing to, you know, take such an aggressive strategy early. But,
yeah.
You know, I mean, so I'm just like, I'd watch it again. I'd watch either guy's next fight. I hope that they don't dramatically, you know, pump the brakes and take them both back a level. But PBC, that's definitely possible. You know, I mean, Garcia follows up the Peterson fight by fighting Malignaggi. Thurman takes, you know, sideways steps for 2 years. So we'll see.
Well, no, and that is I think, a legitimate concern. And we'll just kind of have to see what direction they go in, although the signs are pointing to a rematch. But that actually kind of brings me back a little bit to what I was going to respond to from you, and that is the whole rematch thing. And we've talked about this before in regard to other fights, and, I mean, we'll probably talk about it again because we're going to preview a rematch in a minute, but I don't really know. I on some level do understand why people are so against rematches. And part of that is because fighters fight so seldom that there aren't a whole lot of in-between fights these days, or at least, I mean, even the quote-unquote in-between fights, those are televised too. So I understand why some people are just kind of fundamentally against the rematches, unless the fight was so good that you have to do it again, or so controversial, or such an upset, or something like that. But at the same time, and I said this before, and I'll say it again, Manny Pacquiao, Juan Manuel Marquez, every single time they were going to fight again, people were whining and moaning and pissing and, wow, God, they're going to fight again. And every single time it was like better and better, you know? So, I mean, that's obviously an outlier. That's not every, you know, pairing of, you know, fighters who get rematches and rubber matches. That obviously doesn't happen a lot, but they're not just always bad. And also, to kind of respond to what you had just said, I also agree that neither guy's stock should have really gone down because of this fight. They both fought really hard. They both fought admirably.
Admirably.
I almost said that too. The only real criticism is probably for him, and that is that he was unable to really adjust and find something. That's not like an indictment. That doesn't mean that, oh, shit, dude, he's going to lose against everybody now. But it was kind of concerning, given the size thing, given that, you know, he really needed to come up with something and just was not able to come up with anything at all. And he kind of seemed to, it was like rounds, like maybe like 7 to 10-ish. He just seemed to kind of like go flat, and he just was going through the motions. But, you know, if these are dull fights, if these are the type of fights where people are, like, you know, really complaining and having a tough time, fuck it, dude. I'll take this type of stuff from Premier Boxing Champions any day of the week, no question.
Yeah, and, you know, I like to just see a guy come out and will definitively win fights like this, you know, rather than have it be more of a tactical, boring, you know, where you're not even sure who won and you don't even really care because it could have gone either way because there's a lot of really boring rounds, you know. It's just nice to see a young fighter come up and take advantage of the opportunity the way that Santa Cruz did. And, you know, I think in my mind, I mean, he won back a lot of respect just from me, you know, because, I mean, after the last couple of years, I was starting to get sour a little bit on the guy. Just, you know, it's one thing to, you know, get fed a lot of kind of easy fights in a row, but then to look kind of shitty in those fights is, you know, it's like another indictment. So I think maybe the case was, you know, that he did get up for this fight, and it's not easy to, you know, when you're kind of on the cusp, as he was, being undefeated and getting those, you know, title belts and everything, and being on the cusp of seemingly these bigger things, and then to step back into these fights that no one really cares about. I mean, it probably is difficult, you know, psychologically to really get up for those, and maybe that's part of what we saw, you know. But I thought he looked really good on Saturday, and obviously, you know, biggest fight of his life, and the guy deserves a lot of credit, I think, for just, you know, I think he's better than I thought he was. I mean, it's not like I would, you know, oh, he's going to beat Lomachenko or guys like that, but I wouldn't count him out either, you know?
No, there's no question. And, you know, before, he wouldn't even really have been in that kind of discussion, you know, based on the opponents that he had. And that also kind of teaches us a lesson, too, that it's not always about who the guys are fighting and blah, 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 but there are other things that kind of go into what makes a fight and what, you know, what the things that play into the outcome. But still, the cream does kind of rise to the top eventually, and that is also what we saw with Leo Santa Cruz. He wound up defeating Abner Mattis. And a quick, you know, tiny quick plug, before the fight, I had written that at the Fight City, I had written in my preview that 3 years ago, and I can't remember in what context I brought this up before, but the Abner Mattis versus Anselmo Moreno fight, that was at the Staples Center about 3 years ago. It was like November 2012 or something like that. And Leo Santa Cruz wound up taking on, I want to say, Terrazas or something like that on the undercard. And so afterward, post-fight press conference, blah, 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 Leo Santa Cruz starts calling out Abner Mattis. Later on, when Abner Mattis comes up to talk about his fight, he basically laughed it off. He was like, you know, no offense, but I don't even know who this guy is. You know, he basically played that card. Who is this guy? And so here we are about 3 years later, and Leo Santa Cruz has, you know, dumped him on his ass. Not literally, but, you know,
like
gave
Johnny
him a pretty rough loss. No, not quite like that. But he did give him a pretty, you know, a stern loss, I'd have to say. Yeah. So we'll have to see where it goes from here. But at the very least, that's something a little bit more exciting coming from them two, rather than worrying about, you know, which bum they were going to face or which dude they were going to face that we'd already seen lose to, like, a flyweight or some shit. So this is improvement. This is improvement. So we'll get the praises out now before later on when we talk shit. And as I mentioned earlier, the co-feature to that fight, Santa Cruz Mattis, was a nice, it was a dust-up between Julio Ceja and Hugo Ruiz. I mean, it wasn't a caveman brawl, but it was indeed a fast-paced fight, and Ceja got off to a solid start for getting dropped in the third round, and then he spent the rest of that round retreating, getting dinged around, and he was kind of let off the hook in the next round and then just leveled in the fifth. So, you know, Ruiz got up shaky, sent backwards into the corner, and he was stopped. Now, last week I did say this fight should be good, but the credit goes to these two because they fought their ass off. I mean, that was a nice five-round fight to open up the broadcast, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, really good, great fight. And, you know, good, like you said, I mean, it helps so much to have something like that start off the night, you know, because that's the first time you're tuning in. And for those new viewers, I mean, why would you not want to continue watching, you know, seeing something like that? But, yeah, it was great. Yeah, like you said, I mean, it was very action-packed and exciting and, you know, huge kind of comeback from Ceja, who looked like he might be done a couple rounds earlier and I thought was getting beaten pretty soundly on the cards prior to the knockout, and then, you know, was able to just deliver that punch. And he's going to be an interesting guy to watch at 122 pounds.
Yeah, there's no question, especially somebody who's able to, you know, take a licking like that and then come back and floor the other dude. I mean, geez, man.
Well, his only loss was to McDonald, right? The guy who's fighting on Saturday, the British guy. So they're both PBC. So, you know, once the rematch with Kamita comes on, I mean, you'd expect that Ceja would be right in that mix to get back, you know, on televised on one of these undercards.
Yeah, and it was a fairly close loss, too. It wasn't like he got totally wiped out or, like, you know, leveled or something like that. And on top of that, like, he does seem to have not a following, but I can't remember who his promoter was. Well, anyway, it doesn't really matter. He does kind of have the momentum now anyway that he wound up storming back from. I didn't think he was going to get out of that round. He wound up, you know, going down pretty hard and then getting up, and I was like, oh, man, he looks like shit. He's going to get taken out. And then he got hurt again before the round even ended. So, yeah, that was just a perfect setup for the Santa Cruz-Mares fight. I mean, for the atmosphere, and it was clear that all the people in attendance were, you know, rip-roaring and probably drunk as shit, just like I would have been if I were there. So it looked like a lot of fun anyway.
Yeah, and his only loss was a majority decision loss in England. So that's basically like a W.
Oh, yeah, that's,
you know,
like
those,
a knockout
those
win.
Crooked motherfuckers.
Yeah, British boxing. Where's James Bagg Jr. at? British boxing. Shit. Yeah, I mean, I would be more than happy to welcome these types of co-features from Premier Boxing Champions, and they seem to kind of, you know, we've talked about it before. I don't know. It could be unintentional. Could be accident. Who knows? I literally have no idea. But for whatever reason, they seem to have kind of found this groove with these co-features to a lot of these cards. And some of them have been cards where the headliner just kind of looks blah, like not that good. But then the co-feature, for whatever reason, just kind of winds up saving the show or being much better than the headliner. Like I said, intentional, unintentional, no idea. But, okay, I'll take it.
Well, let's give credit to our PBC's matchmaker, Rick Glaser. Or, no, I'm sorry, who's...
Oh, it's not Rick. He probably isn't, you know, taking time away from his busy sunglasses choosing schedule.
Yeah.
But that's neither here nor there. He knows a lot of felons, you know. He hangs out on the streets. He has a lot of black friends.
Well, he was boys with Tim Coleman, the ill-fated, who's now, I think, standing, you know, faced with a murder charge. So.
Yeah, I was about to say, he was just in the news the other day for some icky shit. That's not real good at all. Hey, man, well, he was, you know, from what I know, he's good friends with Don King, too. And what's the Don been up to? Anybody know?
That's a good
Nobody
point.
Even knows.
Well, he was up to
Nobody
something. He
knows.
Was involved in a fight this weekend, or not involved in it, but, you know, trying to sue to try to prevent it. Yeah.
Well, let's slide right into that fight's DMs then. I mean, the real battle for Los Angeles, that was across town from Santa Cruz Mares and the Forum in Inglewood, as I said, and Sugar Shane Mosley granted Ricardo Mayorga a rematch based on the ramblings of a Twitter account that apparently wasn't even really Mayorga. I mean, that's, you can't script it. You can't make it up in any other sport but boxing. Their 2008 bout ended with the Nicaraguan flat on his back with 1 second remaining in the fight, or like 2 seconds, or whatever it was. It was right at the end. And this fight was pitiful in a number of ways, unfortunately. Mosley can still punch. And I was actually kind of surprised by some of the right hands that he was setting up and landing. I mean, being honest, but there's still some craft there. But he was hesitating a lot. He even got nailed a handful of times, and Mayorga's, you know, slow as molasses. And to top it all off, it's Ricardo Mayorga in 2015. So there's really just not a lot you can take from the result and apply toward Mosley versus a top welterweight, for instance. Is there anyone that's actually good that he could defeat? I don't see it. I mean, when there are the kind of, and he kind of brought this news or this reaction against himself because he tried to call out Marquez, I suppose. You know, he said something about wanting to fight Juan Manuel Marquez. But then Juan Manuel Marquez has been out for a while with a bad knee injury. I'm pretty sure he had at least one surgery. And even so, people are like, "Ugh, Shane, don't do that." Like, this is a dude that's been out for a long time on a knee surgery and is himself like 42. And people are like, "Shane, don't tangle with him."
And,
you know, like,
it should probably be much smaller too.
A dude that, yeah, came up from, you know, 122 pounds at the start of his career. So, yeah,
I don't really have any interest in seeing Shane continue to fight, you know, so can't even really brainstorm opponents for him. I mean, maybe if you said, like, Mosley was fighting Victor Ortiz, I would perk up a little bit, but that's about it, you know? I mean,
I knew there was some way.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, this fight, yeah, it basically, if it was worth $60 to, the only highlight of the entire fight was basically Mayorga's, you know, signature hands down, you know, hit me, sticking his chin out routine, as well as also, you know, Mayorga's wife weeping in the crowd and, you know, shielding his child from, you know, the horror of watching, you know, his father getting beat up. So other than those two things, which probably have been turned into gifts at this point, you know, it was pretty laughable that this was a $60 pay-per-view. I mean, I wanted to support, you know, Mosley and whatever, but, you know, how can this be? Who came up with the price point for this thing? Make it $29.99 or something. But yeah, up against another great fight in the same city too, which I think you could tell really affected the crowd. Which there was like almost nobody at Mosley Mayorga, but it was just a total fiasco. I mean, it was as expected, and I don't really ever want to see either guy fighting again unless it's against Victor Ortiz or, you know, maybe Mayorga against Chavez Jr. Although, I think Chavez Jr. probably could beat Mayorga and Mosley in the same night, even in this dilapidated, you know, marijuana-hazed condition.
Yeah, even in his, dilaudid, Xanaxed out, sitting in a hospital bed with a cup of coffee, staring into the wilderness, vacant look on his face. Self. Yeah, he probably could.
Just give him some of Shane Jr.'s Adderall. It'll perk him right up.
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic.
No drug
testing.
Yeah,
get him on.
no drug
testing. Get him on the uppers and the downers at the same time. Let's do that. Going into this fight, and I mean, I would very much like to support Shane. Seriously, I would have loved to if I just fucking had $60 to burn, which I don't because I'm not like a rich human being. If I just had $60 to burn on just whatever. Sure, man, I'll spend $60 on that pay-per-view. Or if there was like some other fight on there that I was really interested in, or, you know, they wound up getting that the co-feature or the rest of the card really good or something like that, I maybe could have, you know, convinced my wife to take my testicles out of the mason jar she keeps, you know, them in on the side of her bed and let me order that fight. But it wasn't going to happen. Going into the fight, it was almost like listening to Shane Mosley talk. It was a mixture of like desperation because he was talking about what he was doing. He's like, man, I'm leaving tickets on park benches. And I'm like, you're motherfucking leaving tickets on fucking park benches? What? What the fuck is that? What do you mean? Like, literally? Or is that a metaphor for life?
That's a good move.
Like, I'm leaving tickets on the park bench of life. I don't understand. And so I was just kind of like hearing these types of tactics. And on one hand, I'm sitting there going like, you know what? At the very least, that's creative. You know, like he's like doing something to promote and he's not sitting on his ass. But at the same time, like I said, there was that like desperation about it where he started talking about, well, in order to break even, we need to get 30,000 buys. And in my head, I'm thinking 30, okay, they can do 30. But then when I started thinking more about it, I was like, dude, are they going to do 30? I don't know if they're going to do 30, dude. So a part of me just feels bad.
I don't think it did 30, bro.
No.
But I don't know. You know what, though? I was really surprised because actually coming home the other day, I was driving, you know, down the street or whatever, and I saw a bar advertising Mosley versus Mayorga pay-per-view, you know, and Mayweather versus Berto. but really was shocked that, like, a bar would actually order Mosley Mayorga, you know? I mean, it just seemed like such a not, you know, inconsequential fight that had no real buzz about it. And I actually Googled it just a little bit, like, bars showing, and there were a few in the area that were showing it. So,
wow.
I don't know. I mean, you know, you figure if bars are ordering it around the country and maybe a few, you know, crazy, sick degenerates hit the button, maybe they could get up to, you know, around 30,000 buys.
Maybe.
But I don't know.
I mean,
how much do you have any
hope.
Clue? Like, I remember what, like, their pay-per-view with, like, Yvonne Calderon on it, you know, probably like 5 years ago, and it was like, maybe it was like, it was like an integrated sports pay-per-view. And I'm like, I wonder, like, what did things like that used to get in buys? Do you have any idea?
Man, I don't know. I do know that a handful of years ago, like maybe 8 to 10 years ago, when Top Rank was putting on those, like the Pinoy Power pay-per-views,
yeah.
You know, where it was like, nobody was like a huge star. And, you know, they would have Donaire on the, you know, like headliner against somebody who was like not super recognizable or something like that. And those types of cards used to do, you know, in the realm of like 30, 50, stuff like that. And but that was like on the upper end, I think. So, I mean, I just don't even really, yeah, I don't think it would have just done real well. But there is also kind of, and I hinted at it, but there is that kind of other aspect of Mosley Mayorga too that, in my opinion, does deserve at least a little bit of attention, and that's that Shane put up his own money to basically do an independent pay-per-view card. And, you know, I wish I didn't have to be blunt and just say that it wasn't very good, but it wasn't. But, you know, there was, like, the lame musical acts between fights, a pair of ring girls putting on inflatable boxing gloves and, you know, did some sort of display. Much of the enthusiasm and like the wowee, you know, stuff felt really contrived, but I do honestly admire that Shane sallied forth with this thing and stuck it to the bigger promoters in a way, even if it might not have much of an effect. You know, I admire that though.
Yeah, I thought his, what was Victor Ortiz's word about, entrepreneurship? Yeah, I respected Mosley's entrepreneurship. to do that, but
yeah,
no, you know
seriously, pay-per-views, it's a crazy thing. It's a cool thing though.
It's a cool thing though. It's a little controversial. I've never seen a guy that happy to get sucker punched.
I don't know, man. I just, you know, I'm just here, bro. I don't know, man. Fucking Victor Ortiz.
I think he got charged with manslaughter for that, or not manslaughter, but like aggravated. Yeah, he didn't kill anyone. But aggravated assault for the Kenny Chesney concert incident.
Damn, dude! Like, couldn't he have been like Megadeth concert or something? Kenny Chesney? Really?
A little more street cred.
Stomping people out, fucking Partridge Family reunion.
Well, what's
Jesus,
our guy
buddy.
from the like late 70s, early 80s? That dude who used to fight from prison. Who was on HBO a couple times, like light heavyweight. Maybe Ortiz could get a little something like that going.
Are you talking about Tony Ayala?
No. I can't think of the guy's name.
Dewey Bozella. No.
Totally blank. Yeah, yes, Dewey Bozella. Yeah.
Dewey Bozella.
No, I think it was like James Scott or something.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about, yeah. Oh,
there was like one HBO broadcast.
Bring
I just remember watching it on YouTube a while ago. But,
yeah, bring back the prison series and get Victor Ortiz.
Yeah.
Fuck me, dude. Crazy. Well, shit, who else would be on there then? You'd get, what's his name? Jameel McClain, who was running guns in Florida. You got fucking Michael Nunn running coke.
Oh,
you
yeah,
got Panchito Bojado making a run for the border, trying to get away from cops and getting, you know, crash at the San Diego border not far from my house. Good times. There'd be a whole lot. There's definitely no dearth of fighters who have spent a little bit of time in the clink, that's for sure. Ay. Speaking of the clink, though, on CBS this coming Sunday, not Saturday, Sunday, Anthony Durrell faces Marco Antonio Rubio in the next installment of Premier Boxing Champions. So after I just got done singing PBC's praises, we get a headliner like this on cable. So we don't really pay close attention to records and who's undefeated and stuff like that. I mean, that's just not really as important to us as, you know, it is to a lot of other people. It's just not. But, you know, both of these guys are coming off of losses. That's notable. And they're headlining the card. But at least Durrell's loss was not an embarrassing one. But Rubio's loss was bad enough that his own promoter more or less skewered him to the press, like publicly. It was like, this guy's a disgrace. So it makes more sense to have the co-feature headlining. We'll get to that in a minute. But it's just a very peculiar move and one that makes me question whether or not the matchmakers or, you know, schedulers or whatever at PBC are really boxing people. Because, I mean, they have gotten a lot of these co-features and stuff like that right, and there have been some good fights. But stuff like this makes me look at it and go, what?
Yeah, I don't
kind
know.
It was
like
squandering
they,
a CBS date, but whatever.
Pulled Rubio's name out of a hat or something. You know,
pulled it out of somewhere.
Yeah, it's not a, you know, it's pretty disappointing because it was a competitive fight. Actually, I was at Anthony Durrell against Badu Jack, and you know, I thought it was actually a good fight. It had some, you know, good exchanges and exciting moments. At least exceeded expectations, which were pretty low. And I thought it was reasonably competitive. You know, and I know I was in my extreme minority on this, but I actually thought that, you know, it to me felt like almost could have gone either way. And being there live, I thought maybe Durrell edged it, but. So I don't know, man. Like to now step back and you know, you're at 168 pounds, and I think Durrell's proven himself to be, you know, a top 10 guy in the division and a pretty good fighter. But now, you know, you take a competitive loss to a guy, and Jack's going to go on and fight George Groves. So I don't understand, you know, why Durrell, instead of taking on another top 168 guy, he's going to fight, you know, an old kind of, you know, faded middleweight. You know, who just can't come in off just a debacle of a loss. I mean, it's not even like, I mean, against Golovkin, it wasn't even like he really took
a
beating.
And about a year ago, too.
Yeah.
Almost a year ago.
It was just weird, though, wasn't it? I mean, it just felt like he was just way over his head and then just kind of like got knocked out, but didn't really seem like he got hurt.
Yeah, I mean, it was a quick hook. It wasn't like, trust me, if I take that punch, I'm probably going to be like out cold. So I'm not, you know, trying to make like I'm some, you know, badass that's going to live through that. But no, it wasn't a particularly hard punch, at least, you know, in terms of the punches that usually land from Gennady Golovkin. It wasn't like the biggest. I mean, it just wasn't, it didn't seem like it was that crazy. And then he went down and was like, had this bewildered look on his face, like, fuck this, dude, I'm done. No more of that. And, I mean, it was great to be there live and the atmosphere and everything, but it was disgraceful. It was shitty. He was basically disowned by Mexico after that fight. You know, people embraced Golovkin as the Mexican and was like, get this guy out of here. Boo this man. Boo. It was bad.
You bow
so,
this
I mean,
man. It's the opposite. The opposite
it.
Of that.
It was bad. And so, I mean, it...
Well,
but
Patrick, obviously he was drained making 160 pounds after all these years. So now that he's at his natural weight, you're gonna see a resurgent, you know, almost a vintage Marco Rubio.
Yeah, and of course, you know, I think that he had even started at 154. Don't quote me, but I'm pretty sure he did. But even so, is it possible that PBC just doesn't have somebody at 168 to feed to him, or can't get somebody at 168? I guess that's possible. I don't know. But at the same time, it's like, couldn't you get a more legitimate middleweight to move up then? Literally, Marco Antonio Rubio is the best one that you could get.
It's also, like, to me, like, the worst type of style matchup, when the younger guy is more of the boxer who's really quick and quick hands and that kind of thing, and then the against, like, a plodding, older, slower fighter. It's can be just, like, the worst, because it's going to, I think, just be target practice for Durrell, you know, for as long as it lasts, and there won't be any drama. I mean, at least if maybe the roles are over and the younger guy is more of a kind of a plodding, like a face first kind of fighter, and the older guy is like more crafty boxer, then there's some kind of, maybe there's some way. But in this case where Durrell has like every physical advantage and he's also, you know, the style just usually doesn't work well for a fighter like Rubio. So, yeah, I don't see any way that this can even be remotely competitive. I don't really understand why it was made. Like I said, I mean, it felt like they just kind of just pulled Marco Antonio Rubio's name out of thin air. Like, there has to be a better opponent somewhere, but.
Yeah, I would think so. Well, and it almost feels as though PBC had this, it's almost like they had told Anthony Durrell that before the Badu-Jack fight, don't worry about it, you're going to be headlining your next fight no matter what. And so they just already had it all mapped out, and they just kind of had to, like, you know, put shit together to fit that pre-molded, you know, schema. I could be just totally pulling that out of my ass. But it sure feels that way, because it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense, the matchup anyway. But the support bout, anyway, for Durrell Rubio is a rematch between Jamie McDonnell and Tomoki Kameda. Their first fight was on the card the weekend after Mayweather-Pacquiao. It was a close fight, likely difficult to score for many people, and it seemed to come down to the wire, and Kameda moved a lot in the last few rounds, likely didn't punch enough, wasn't really aggressive enough, and dropped those pretty crucial rounds. So it wasn't so much about McDonald looking great, though neither fighter was dominant. Both are only okay punchers. This is probably going to be a distance fight again, but should be another hard-fought one. I mean, you got any love for this Yorkshire lad, James?
I'm liking the fight. Have you seen Jamie McDonald's significant other? Because I have a lot of love for her, if I'm thinking of the right person. I hope I'm thinking of the right person. But
I don't know. I'd have to
Google. Give that a Google when you get a shot there. It's giving Rachel Cordingley a run for her money. But,
really?
Yeah. I got love for it, man. I think the fight's going to be good. The first fight was really good. I personally remember kind of thinking that Kameda maybe got the better of it, but McDonald, like you said, definitely rallied big in the last couple rounds, and it seemed like maybe there was a little edge and skill to Kameda, but McDonald was just kind of, you know, willing himself to make it a closer fight, just throwing more punches and showing a lot of heart and everything. And so, I think it's great that they're doing it again. I actually completely spaced out about it. So when you mentioned it to me before the show, I think that's the reason to tune in on Saturday. And maybe, Durrell Rubio will provide a couple laughs, but that's about it. And your boy Andre might should be there in the first row, like listening to with giant headphones on.
Yeah, fuck it, dude. I just can't stand that guy. At least his brother's been in some worthwhile fights, for crying out loud. Andre Durrell. Jesus.
I like Andre, man. First of all, he's fought a great level of opposition. A lot of that was, the Super Six before the brain injury thing. But just taking that fight with DeGale, I mean, that's a really tough fight. I think DeGale is a legitimate guy at super middleweight, And so it's kind of like, though personally, Andre Durrell, Adrian Broner, they may not be, the most likable guys or whatever. At least they're taking tough fights. Relative to the rest of the PBC stable. So it does make you wonder kind of like, who's the favored guys that are getting these real cushy matchups when they're making Andre Durrell go out there and fight DeGale, who I think is, arguably top five super middleweight.
Well, I mean, I have brought it up before, and I don't have any, hard evidence for it or anything like that, but it feels to me like, especially in Broner's case, it kind of feels like the brass or the higher-ups or whoever it is that's, you know, doing PR and shit like that at PBC, well, not PR, but HR, I should say, at PBC, just to hear, throw every fucking acronym that you can think about there, ASAP, PBC, PBC, but if whoever it is, you know, controlling this type of stuff at the Premier Boxing Champions, it almost feels like they view Adrian Broner as somebody that's, like, dispensable. You know, like, he's draws a lot of fans and he's controversial, but he's a guy that almost seems like he could just lose at any given moment because he fucked around too much between fights, or he didn't maintain his weight, or, you know, he gets caught with some punch, or, you know, gets wobbled, or messed around, or, you know, just wasn't paying attention, or something like that. He just seems like, to me, like they're aware that he's kind of almost a liability. So, yeah, but you do have a good point.
They're matching him tougher, but, you know, but they're also giving him an opportunity, you know, where yeah. other guys aren't getting that. I mean, like, what the hell does Danny Garcia have to gain from fighting Malignaggi?
Well, and also on this whole Broner business, he's going to be thrown in after he just got a loss. He's going to be thrown in against, Alakverdiev, right?
Right.
Khabib.
Who's not Alakverdiev. A bad fighter at 140 pounds.
Not at all.
They're both, coming off losses. But yeah, you know, I mean, right, exactly. And that's probably a better fighter than, you know, the last couple guys that Garcia fought in the division. Since the Peterson fight was over the limit for some, you know, inexplicable reason.
Yeah,
but,
for no reason whatsoever. Yeah, so, I mean, you do have a point there. You do have a point that, you know, for all the shit that I could say about Andre Durrell or anybody could say, including me, about Adrian Broner, they have been match tough at times, and that deserves respect because not all of their fighters, especially in PBC, are, you know, seem willing or seem like they want to push for that. Some of them, a lot of them, seem very comfortable with a lower level of opposition, which is not super respectable. So I do appreciate that, you know, a lot of these dudes are pushing for it. Some
yeah, I like guys calling out like names at the end of fights, you know, and I hate that PBC party line of like, oh, I'll talk to Al Haymon, you know, and do this. You know, I think that's the way to build up fights is by calling people out, you know, and saying...
Well, I don't know, man. Speaking of, you got Adonis Stevenson in his car singing, you need to call Al Haymon. That's a good party line.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, that was pretty god-awful. I think that basically lowered my standards for humanity overall. It was pretty horrible.
Yeah, there's you know, PBC so
that
far, I mean, I'm giving it a solid C.
No. I don't know, but that song was worse than Adonis Stevenson being a former pimp and sex offender, I'm just saying. No, it wasn't at all. Where would I rate them? Overall so far, I guess about a C, maybe a C+, because, man, as much as they do deserve criticism for a whole lot of things, probably first and foremost that they have a large stable and seem unwilling to just outright match two guys rather than build up some bullshit and do it. That's a chief complaint. That's a big complaint right out in front. But it is still new, and I do think that there is, you know, that is a decent point when people say, dude, it's only been like 4 or 5 months. That's true. It has only been 4 or 5 months. And so it is going to take time to build more of a brand or to kind of get more momentum going. But there certainly seems to be a lot more they could be doing to build that momentum and are not doing. So I can't give them, like, a good grade. But it could get a lot better.
Yeah, they could have done some blockbuster stuff this fall. There was no reason why they didn't need to. You know, they had the ESPN series. They had these great dates and this huge platform to launch something, and they gave us Garcia Malignaggi and Thurman Collazo. So, yeah, Mara's Santa Cruz is a good fight, but, you know, I mean, this is the third outing, and the first two were kind of basically crap. I mean, the type of fights aren't going to attract any new fans. They're just time wasters for the, you know, the A-sides. And they didn't really show us anything about any, you know, I mean, and there was nothing to gain for, you know, Thurman or Garcia. And, you know, and there was kind of, you know, in Thurman's case, I mean, there were a couple shaky moments in that fight. So it kind of hurt his stock, if anything. But, you know, you could have just gone right into, you know, how about Thurman versus Danny Garcia? Or, you know, Sean Porter versus a top guy or whatever, you know, and give us something big. And but it's just, as boxing fans, we're suckers because we just keep coming back no matter what it is. So, of course, they're going to keep their cards close to the vest and prolong things for as long as they can. Why make Garcia Thurman now? Why not just put him in these two shitty fights and we'll make a big fight next spring for one of them? You know, and that's just how it go. And, like, I'm feeling like, let's just do it now. Let's fuck it. Let's do it live.
Do it live.
You know, let's just do it now and let's, you know, let see what happens, and then next year there'll be new other stuff to happen. You know, but I feel like you just consistently keep making those big fights, because the thing is, we're not talking about like prospects or guys who are just kind of working their way up to being like you know, top of the solid pros.
These
guys are at the top of the division
fighters
already, right? And they're at the top of the division. They're top men. Garcia was a lineal champion or whatever.
Up.
No, so they, it should just be one big fight after another at this point. So that's just, you know, that's, so I can't give him, like, a good grade. I mean, maybe I'd give him, like, a B-minus just to not be a dick. But realistically, I think you're probably right. It's more in that C-plus type of category. The one thing that's worked out for them, though, is I think a lot of their fights have turned out to be, you know, more entertaining, more competitive than expected. So, you know, there's been some good stuff, and I like how they're traveling. You know, they brought a couple shows to Chicago, which was kind of worthy to get to see some fighters that, you know, I wouldn't have otherwise gotten to see. I'm used to just the Mike Malos of the world and the Archer Spilkas and all that, but. So, you know, I think it's been all right, but I think you just keep making good 50-50 type fights and everyone will be down. You know, but it all comes down to the whole profit margin. Like, maybe they've figured it out that, hey, we're still going to get a certain number of viewers putting on non-competitive stuff and we're going to make this amount of money. And so we can just kind of string it out, and then just as we've completely tried boxing fans' patience, then we'll give them like a gem. You know? And I don't know, it could just be one gem after another. I don't understand why it's not. To me, none of those guys have anything to really lose in terms of, like, none of those guys are some, you know, economic, like, you know, like machine that's going to all come crumbling down if any of them take a loss. I mean, they're all still relatively unknown in the mainstream, and these are guys I think you need to be pushing into one huge fight after another, and whoever comes out on top and is winning and exciting, you know, you're going to make a lot of fans and make that person into a star.
Exactly.
So,
and that's the thing, is that in the long term, that this kind of matchmaking, it might be somewhat helpful short term. You might be getting some, you know, immediate returns, but long term, you're actually hurting yourself and the fighters. You're better off testing the fighters sternly, and I don't mean just, you know, fucking throwing them to the wolves, but, you know, testing the fighters sternly and building them along, testing them against different styles and making sure they have all sorts of, you know, different looks and, you know, hot wetness and wet hotness and all sorts of shit like that. So then, you know, when they actually do get a serious test, they're ready. Not, you know, you're maneuvering them and guiding them very carefully. So then the next time you put him in against this difficult journeyman who he was supposed to have an easy time with, he totally is fucking bewildered and doesn't know what to do. And now you wind up having to rebuild or start over in a PR sense because that didn't work out the way you wanted it to. And so it really doesn't help them as much as they think it does, especially if they're in this for the long term. And the way that they're doing matchmaking, the way that all of this stuff is unfolding, it is suggesting that they are trying to do some long-term stuff. So I think that they need to really reassess how they're putting these fights together and, you know, what exactly they're expecting to get out of this. If they're just trying to make stars, You know, they're not trying to make great fighters, and they're just trying to make, you know, celebrities and stars, then I guess maybe they're going about it the right way. Maybe. That remains to be seen, too. But there's a lot of work to be done. There's no question, and there's a lot more they could be doing.
Yeah, and, yeah, I mean, what more can you say? You know, I can't forget, you know, that we just, the previous two ESPN installments were, you know, Collazo and Malignaggi headlining, you know, that's like Oscar De La Hoya against Steve Forbes. You know, it's like, but that was like a tune-up that was like a pay-per-view guy coming back to regular HBO, and everyone knew that it was just like, you know, I mean, this is like, they're putting those same type of fight on and acting like it's like a great main event, and, you know, there's no, I mean, fuck, it's not brain surgery here. You know, if a guy just had a humiliating loss in his last fight, they shouldn't be, you know, headlining the main event on this, like, new platform that's supposed to be, like, this great, you know, outlet to, like, introduce to viewers. And twice in a row, that's what we had.
Yeah. And that just doesn't make any sense. That's what doesn't make any sense. At the very least with, you know, at the very least with Santa Cruz and Mattes, they were both coming off a string of wins, even if we didn't like the opposition. But that at least, you know, built the, even if it was a slight mirage, that, you know, these are two guys who are on a roll. But it just doesn't really make a lot of sense, some of the decisions that are being made.
Yeah, and there's a difference between a guy like Mahrez who, you know, like, to me, the loss to Johnny Gonzalez, I wouldn't say that's, like, humiliating. You know, that's a good young fighter who's on a run, gets in with a big puncher, takes one or two huge punches, and gets stopped, you know. But things like Malignaggi getting just blown away by Sean Porter, and that's a guy in Malignaggi who's come up short against the highest level of fighter pretty much his entire career. And then, you know, Collazo, who's just been completely shut out by Amir Khan, has nothing significant on his resume in, you know, 6 years, 7 years. It's a different story with opponents like that, you know. Mahrez at least had, I mean, Mahrez's credentials were, like, much better than those guys in terms of being an opponent, you know. And I don't know, the odds show that, but we'll see coming up. I mean, we'll see what they make, you know. We'll see what fights that they make. But it's just the stagnation that's gone on with some of those guys at welterweight makes no sense to me. You know, if I was Al Haymon and those guys, I'd be throwing huge money at Maidana trying to get him to come in and fight Thurman, because I think Maidana's profile was raised a little bit by the two Mayweather fights, and people know he's a tough guy, and he got the win over Broner, gave Mayweather a great fight the first fight, you know. So I'd be trying to make something like that happen, or getting Danny Garcia in there against, you know, against a guy like Sean Porter or something, you know, getting the winners fighting each other, and then really coming, you know, getting someone to emerge from that, you know, showing kind of same kind of thing with like Amir Khan. Like, it just sounds like they're going to keep making these weird fights that no one's really demanding, and, you know, I just don't understand it.
Yeah, that's kind of the part of it that I'm not getting with the matchmaking, is that the build up for the fights, that I don't know who it is, or are they actually doing studies? Are they kind of like hitting the streets? Is anybody actually even looking at any type of social media, you know, regarding boxing when they're making these fights? Are they, do they have a team of people, even just like three people, combing through tweets and stuff like that when the announcements for these fights are made, so that they can see this, these swaths of people looking at, for example, you know, what is it, Peter Quillen versus, you know, dancer Chippendale guy, and going, what the fuck?
Yeah.
You know, nobody is looking at this fight and going, sweet, except for like Zarafa's family and shit like that. So do they have people who are looking at Twitter or Facebook or whatever and just going, oh, damn, this shit's getting just skewered.
That's
maybe
another great
we ought
example.
To rethink this. You know,
wait,
like,
that's a great example. And then same thing with Adonis Stevenson and fighting, what's his name? Carpathy, you know,
yeah.
It's they're huge mismatches that nobody wants, you know, and there's, but in those guys' cases, that's another, I think that's getting at another problem at PBC, and the same kind of thing I think with Deontay Wilder at heavyweight is like, you don't really have any, there's in some divisions they're going to run out of really worthy opponents they can make within their own stable, and with like Stevenson, probably the best they can do is that Fonfara rematch. You know, and much as I love Fonfara, there's a couple other guys who are probably much more deserving, I mean, obviously Kovalev, but, you know, of getting a fight with Stevenson. And I think same thing with Quillen. I mean, there's not much more there at middleweight beyond, you know, he can't fight Golovkin, it's not PBC, you know, and it's HBO. So that's going to be a problem, but that's why I think the biggest thing that bugs me is all these fighters that they have, all under PBC, all in the same stable, and yet they're not fighting each other. And, you know, and that I think that needs to happen. I mean, they have four or five welterweights who are in the top ten at welterweight. There's no reason they can't be fighting. But we'll see, man. I mean, Stevenson's a great example because what can who can Stevenson even fight at this point other than Fonfara in a rematch? And Quillen, you know, what's there for Quillen? What's the point of competing at middleweight? I mean, I guess in Quillen's case, maybe he hangs out there. No, actually, because I was thinking that they're Golden Boy, and obviously he's not Golden Boy anymore. So Quillen's a PBC. He's not going to get a Canelo fight at 160. So what's really there for him? You know, the big money fight would be like Canelo Cotto winner or Golovkin, and he's going to get shut out of that, and nobody's going to care about any other opponents for him.
Well, I mean, this actually does kind of raise a bit of an interesting discussion, and we're not going to go on for too much longer here, but I did want to bring this up since we're talking about it, but it's kind of like the main events debacle, the most recent thing with Stevenson and Kovalev with the purse bid and everything. So, okay, I'll try to just kind of be brief, but just for if anybody's listening and they're like, what is he talking about, debacle? So basically what had happened was it had come down to a purse bid that they were going to try to make Stevenson versus Kovalev. And basically, main events pulled Sergey Kovalev out of the purse bid before the purse bid could be completed because their position was Al Haymon has more money than us, which means he's simply going to outbid us no matter what we bid. And then that means that Sergey Kovalev will then be obligated to fight on a network contractually that he cannot fight on because he is contractually obligated to fight on only HBO. And so, I mean, there are a whole bunch of little separate problems here. Problem one, why is he only exclusive to HBO? That makes no sense because a fighter should be able to fight on any fucking network. That's never really made a lot of sense to me. However, that's how they operate and the networks run the show. And that's how that is. So that also kind of, you know, raises an interesting issue with these other fighters, like Quillen, for example. So, then if they are able to somehow maneuver Peter Quillen into a position as a mandatory or something like that by beating just these total fucking bums at 160 pounds, which happens because that happens every single day with the Alphabet organizations where guys get into mandatory positions by beating nobodies, they could potentially maneuver Quillen into that mandatory position to where there's a purse bid, and now they got someone like, for example, Golovkin or somebody else, and someone who is not big enough that they can ditch the belt. You know what I mean? And so then now they have to go through this purse bid, and then they have to fucking, you know, do something that breaks their HBO contract. So even if that fight doesn't come off, it's causing a whole lot of disruption. And that's actually something that Nicole Duva had talked about when we had talked about the whole PBC thing, when we had had her on our show a couple months ago, that, you know, if Haymon or PBC aren't able to just make fights outright, they might just try to disturb shit enough so that it throws everybody else off and ruins it. So is that what's happening or what's going to happen? No, I don't know. I have absolutely no idea, but I think that that's, you know, a valid discussion and it's a valid concern.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, at this point, I mean, Golovkin is certainly a bigger, in terms of drawing power and in terms of, you know, notoriety and economically and everything like that, than Quillen is. You know,
no,
and that's
question,
kind of,
yeah.
You know, and maybe a couple years ago that wasn't the case, but Golovkin, by just repeatedly being shown on HBO, you know, kind of the old organic way, just became, you know, a real star attraction. And you've seen that with the way that, you know, the fight against Lemieux is selling out. But, you know, so there might be some weird situations where they'll be willing to, you know, like DeGale's not with PBC and they did the Andre Durrell DeGale thing. I mean, maybe, you know, there are situations where they'd be willing to work with them or let a guy go over and fight on HBO, but I don't know. I mean, for the most part, it's probably safest to just regard PBC as almost its own separate league at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it essentially is, because by all, you know, from all reports, HBO is not going to work with Heyman. Heyman is not going to work with HBO. Golden Boy is not going to work with Heyman. Heyman is not going to work with Golden Boy. So those
Mosley
two
is not
going to
work
with
Heyman.
Yeah. Oh, well, that just kills it all. That's a deal breaker. So that, you know, those two things right there are pretty big. Those are huge divides. Divides are bad. We want to be able to match anybody with anybody.
You're right. You're right. And but at the moment, you know, I mean, luckily, I mean, really, other than Kovalev Stevenson, there aren't that many real, you know, huge fights that I think.
That's true.
Obviously, there's intriguing things you could make between, you know, an HBO guy and a PBC fighter and all that. But I think PBC has enough business in, of its own to just make a lot of good fights there. And there's good things happening on HBO. You know, Canelo Cotto is going to be the, you know, second biggest event of the year, and possibly, you know, I mean, I think has fight of the year potential if it goes the right way. But either way, it's going to be unbelievable event for boxing, and you know, just guy like Golovkin, I think, is more compelling than anybody in the PBC stable, you know. And you're getting Chocolatito on the airwaves, so there's good things happening over there. I mean, I think, you know, this is more of a problem that's going to probably develop in the next couple of years if, like, someone in that welterweight landscape really distinguishes themselves, because that's really the money division right now, you know. And if one of those guys somehow, like Keith Thurman or whoever, becomes the guy, you know, and then on HBO and on the HBO side, if you have, you know, a guy like Terrence Crawford or, you know, whoever, if Canelo can beat Cotto and continue to be, you know, a top guy in the sport, there'll probably be another one of those big, you know, Mayweather-Pacquiao type of pay-per-view events that's going to be obstructed because of all the politics, you know, and that's going to be, you know, even more annoying. But I think with what's going on with Stevenson and Kovalev's just been so dominant lately and fought a better level of opposition. And after seeing what he did against Hopkins and Pascal, I mean, I think he's clearly in the public's eyes become, you know, a significant favorite against Stevenson anyway, and kind of regarded as the number one guy. So it seems like demand for that fight has kind of waned a little bit. A lot of which just because Stevenson's been fighting, you know, not good opposition. And, it's maybe the same thing like the Santa Cruz thing. Like, how is Stevenson going to get up? He has a potential huge fight, you know, sitting there for him with Kovalev. He has big fight with, you know, could have a big fight with Pascal that's not going to happen. He never, you know, fought Hopkins, who is, you know, one of the main guys in the light heavyweight division. So, meanwhile, he's fighting guys like Saki Obika, which, again, was from, like, the Durrell Rubio school of matchmaking. He's pulling Spica out there for, you know, and now he's fighting Carpency. So, you know, it's... Like, I don't think Carpency's that bad. I don't think Carpency's that, you know, much worse of an opponent than Mohamedy was for Kovalev. But, you know, Kovalev was coming off of Pascal and Bernard, who are two top guys. So, but it's just, yeah, Stevenson, I think, has really seen, at least, you know, in terms of, like, the American boxing audience, I think Stevenson has really taken a step back into the consciousness. And I don't know if there's as much demand for Stevenson Kovalev as there was, you know, a year or two ago.
And also, I mean, from the sound of it, I'm not there, so I can't say for sure. But from the sound of it, Adonis Stevenson just is not a huge draw in Montreal, even.
That's
so
the impression
it sounds,
I get, too.
Well, I mean, don't get me wrong, because it's like if he's drawing a handful of 1,000 people, that's still better than a lot of fighters, and that's not nothing. But... you know, compared to the likes of Lucien Boutte, David Lemieux, it just doesn't, you know, and even Jean Pascal, Jean Pascal, yeah, it sounds like he's just not, you know, he's kind of sucking hind teeth there. But, yeah, and also on top of that, with the Adonis Stevenson situation here, he strikes me as the type of fighter and also the age of the fighter who could just kind of get ransacked by one of these dudes any day. Tommy Carpency, probably not. But, you know, somebody maybe slightly above that level who could punch, I could see it.
Well, we saw Fonfara be a lot more competitive against Stevenson than most people expected, you know, and I think a lot of that Fonfara is a good fighter, but I do think that Stevenson will be vulnerable. You know, and his whole kind of legacy claim to, you know, the lineage and all that was from knocking out what I consider to be a pretty, you know, damaged version of Chad Dawson.
Proven to be, in hindsight, he's definitely proven to be
and
just absolutely.
Stevenson was in a war with Donovan George right before that, you know, the summer before that Fonfara fight. I mean, before the Dawson fight.
The Dawson fight, yeah.
Yeah, so,
yeah,
it, you know, I think he's absolutely vulnerable against top guys. I mean, I don't know. I think had he fought Hopkins rather than Kovalev fighting Hopkins, I think it would have been a much more competitive fight than Kovalev, you know. I mean, I think that against a certain style. I mean, I do think Stevenson's a really good boxer and he can punch. And I think you know, I'm not saying that Kovalev would just run over him, but I think at this point you have to regard Kovalev as a pretty big favorite, and his resume is just just stronger. He's fought better guys at light heavyweight, you know.
There's no question. He just has a better resume all around, especially recently. And he doesn't have that stoppage loss to, his name, Darnell Boone, you know, a handful of years back. And he killed a guy. He did kill a guy. So, he's got an extra...
He's just generally a psycho, you know?
Racist psycho, too. Or potentially
racist
psycho.
It's racially ignorant, that bad.
Allegedly racist. Well, I mentioned it... earlier on, before we get going, but I was just going to say that Josh Warrington and Joel Brunker fight, I believe it for us would be earlier in the day, Saturday, on Sky Sports, and it's probably not going to end by knockout. Neither guy is much of a puncher, but probably going to be a lively contest, I would imagine, decent featherweight fight. And also the return of Martin Murray, the return of Tony Bellew, and a handful of other dudes. That's pretty much all, though.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm a Martin Murray guy.
I forgot to say, dude, we gotta give a shout out to your boy Andre Berto's HGH gut. What the fuck is up with his abdominal muscles, dude? He has like a beer gut, but with a six pack. What is going on? Something's wrong.
I didn't see those pictures. Distended abdomen or something. No, I don't know.
Yeah. Looking like,
but I'm not
wavering
on my pick of Berto by knockout. So you're gonna see history with a Y on next Saturday.
What would happen if that actually happened? Like, you know, we're just la-di-da-ing through the fight, and it's just kind of pedestrian. People are snoring. People are starting to get up and leave. It's like middle of round 9. Oh fuck, dude! I wish shit! You know, Floyd's out cold. What would happen?
It's easy to say in retrospect, but it might actually be even better than if Pacquiao had somehow beaten Floyd or knocked Floyd out. Just because it would be so crazy and unexpected, you know, and
that would be the ultimate, like, the ultimate just screw you from people who hate Floyd. Like, you just got dumped on your ass by a can.
Yeah.
That would be great.
But, you know, I think for a while, though, I mean, I do think that at this point in Floyd's career, and obviously, like, I don't remotely expect that anything like that's going to happen. You know, I mean, I think it's going to be a pretty, really dominant win. But I think at Floyd's age, I mean, I think it's possible that at some point this fight, you know, next, if he keeps fighting or whatever, that maybe some weird, random, you know, huge underdog guy could knock him out. And I think that, you know, at that point, it will be written up because of age, and because, you know, look, all fighters get old, and you just lose that step and lose a little bit of your reflexes, and bam, you know, maybe he takes a really clean shot and gets hurt. And so, I mean, I think at this point in Floyd's legacy, like, it's not going to diminish anything. That's why it's so unfair with Roy Jones that, you know, his entire 10-year run of being basically like the most dominant fighter in the entire sport against pretty good competition, although obviously not great competition for, you know, a stretch, but, you know, is wiped out because he's, you know, knocked out by Tarver and Glenn Johnson, and now, you know, he's, you know, has 10 losses on his career or whatever, and he's still fighting, is kind of a joke. you know, and if Floyd's the same, if he should happen to suffer some crazy knockout or whatever, it's not going to be like, Berto got the better of him, you know, yeah, of course, but really the story will just be that, you know, Mayweather is almost 40 years old, and that's what happens to guys, you know?
He will never
lose a fight in his prime is kind of the point that I'm trying to make here. You know, is that whether or not Floyd ends up retiring undefeated or not, I think it's the time's come where, you know, whatever happens, he's no longer really in his prime. You know, and he could fall off the cliff at any point. So even if Berto does somehow land some miracle shot and beats him, I mean, the story is going to be more just about Mayweather. You know, the Mayweather era is over, rather than that he, finally met his superior in the ring.
Yeah, it wouldn't be Andre Berto is now the next great boxing superstar. I mean, you know, that would have been if Manny Pacquiao landed a left hand that knocked him out cold. That would have been like, holy shit. Manny Pacquiao just became, you know, the biggest boxing star since Ali. Holy shit, you know. But
yeah.
Now,
there were a couple opportunities. I think if Canelo had been able to somehow compete with him and get a win, he would have gotten a lot of credit for it or whatever. Obviously, Pacquiao, just because of the storyline, and they're still number one and number two, pound for pound, going into it, you know. But I think after that Pacquiao fight, I think no matter what happens, I mean, Floyd's going to be such a big favorite against any of his opponents. That, you know, it's like when Buster Douglas knocked out Mike Tyson, it didn't make him Mike Tyson, you know? It spoke more to the deficiency. I mean, that was, you know, Tyson was younger, obviously. It's not a great comparison. But, you know, if he does lose at some point, it's going to be to a massive underdog, and I think the storyline will be more that just Floyd got old.
Totally. Yeah, so. No, there have been times where guys have risen to the occasion and beaten someone great and then gone on to have a great career themselves. It's not out of the question. But, yeah, often, you know, when it does come down to that, like a guy finally losing, there are a lot of things that, you know, went together to make that happen. Like that Tyson loss, for instance. But
yeah,
we'll see.
I hope to see it someday. I mean, I hope to see Mayweather lose. You know, I'm not going to lie about that. Just because I think it, you know, it'd be crazy. And that's, you know, we're not going to expect it. And if it ever happens, it's going to be a huge upset. I don't think anyone will ever have as close of odds that Manny Pacquiao had against Floyd for the rest of his career,
you know,
because he's not going to take a fight against Golovkin. He's not going to take a fight against somebody who would even be close to him. You know, so the best case scenario is that he'll fight a guy like Thurman or Garcia or somebody like that, and it'll just still be his usual probably 6-1, 7-1 favorite.
Well, I mean, you know, fucking Floyd, dude. I don't know. It's not even necessarily that I want to see him lose. It's just, it's almost kind of like too late. Like, there are the years where a loss against, you know, Floyd Mayweather taking a loss really meaning something, or it's kind of long gone.
Right.
But
right.
That's whatever, kind of, you know, I know he has supporters, and a lot of supporters are like, come on, he's saying he's not going to fight anymore after the Berto fight. You got to take him at his word. Like, well, no, you don't, because 99.9% of all fighters say shit like that and then come back. And on top of that, he just bought a $5 million car. That's not generally the kind of spending habit that lends to keeping your money for more than a few years. So I wouldn't really expect him to be staying retired based on the spending habits, at least.
I wouldn't necessarily be surprised if, you know, he took an extended hiatus and maybe kind of let things play out so that he could get another dance partner that would actually, you know, be an attraction and draw some, you know, do some big numbers again. And maybe it does end up being Pacquiao in a rematch if Pacquiao can string together a couple good wins. Because I mean, who knows what to believe, but it sounds like Arum is ready to match Pacquiao pretty tough coming back. You know, he didn't get knocked out again or anything like that. He lost a tactical boxing match, and, you know, he's been cured by the salt water baths. So, you know, but or whether one of these guys, you know, if Keith Thurman or one of those guys emerges. But the thing is, like, going into next spring, there's still not a big fight for him. It's the same dilemma that he's having against Berto. It's, you know, the pay-per-view numbers aren't going to be there. So I wouldn't be surprised if he takes, you know, some time off, hopes that another superstar emerges, or maybe hopes that Pacquiao gets, you know, kind of comes back and looks good or whatever, and then try to make another huge fight. But yeah, I'd be really surprised if we never see him fight again. I think the odds are heavily against that.
Well, I just, you know, I hope that when he does retire or whatever, he just can keep himself out of trouble this time, because, I mean, I do have to admit, though, it was pretty impressive to see him go to jail just like Muhammad Ali.
Nelson Mandela, too.
Impressive.
It was,
yeah.
Reminded me a lot of that, too. But, yeah, you know, no, I don't wish anything bad for him. I mean, you know, I obviously there's stories you hear, and it sounds like he's not really a great guy, you know, probably has kind of a violent, you know, dark side that we don't really understand, which is, you know, totally not uncommon for boxers. But, you know, I also do think that, I don't know, man, you know, I have some sympathy with, you know, the types of role models that he had in his life and everything, and being groomed into being a superstar from such a young age. Like, it's not surprising that it's happened. The way that it has, you know, but yeah, in his personal life, he does sound pretty fucking vile. But there are some rare moments where I actually do appreciate some elements of Mayweather's personality. And like, for example, you know, I thought in the post-fight press conferences and things like that, you know, you see a little bit more of a, you know, like authentic version of the guy and you know, I think it's just the kind of shtick and the public persona that's been the same kind of story for years and has gotten really stale, combined with all of the horrible, you know, like not just allegations, but, you know, conviction and having had just multiple incidents of domestic violence. You know, it's one thing to get accused of it one time or whatever, but to have this, you know, long track record and multiple accusations and a couple times where you actually, you know, took a conviction and served time, you know, it's, you know, the evidence is pretty much there that, you know, that he's a, you know,
dirt
a violent
bag.
Person in his private life. And that's horrible. Yeah.
Bill Cosby disagrees, but go on.
No. I'm not trying to like defend the guy or anything. I'm just saying that like, you
no,
know,
no,
there are some, there, you know, it's more complicated. I mean, like, do I like him? No, of course not. I just said I root against him in every single fight. But there are parts of his personality and parts of, you know, his story or whatever that I think is, like, you know, a little bit more like, compelling than some people, you know, give him credit for or whatever.
No,
you know?
That's true. And there, and on top of that, well, not on top of that, but, I mean, his childhood, he was basically raised by people who were on drugs all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, fuck, that's not. I'm definitely not going to be celebrating that.
Floyd Senior is probably not. Yeah, he's not rolling around with the father of the year, you know, baseball cap.
Yeah, and from the sounds of it, you know, from the sounds of it, Roger was getting into his share of shit too. Well, we know he was. You know, Roger's been putting his hands on females too. But I mean, you know, to come from that background, on one hand, you kind of almost have to ask yourself, what kind of person do you expect to come out of that? You know, what do you expect people to thrive coming out of those situations? And if you do, that's kind of foolish, even though it does happen sometimes. But yeah, no, he does have a compelling story, and he's not just all 1,000% dirtbag, and that's how you sum him up as a person. You know, he actually does have some redeeming qualities. And I do agree, you actually do get to see that sometimes, especially after, like, you know, when he gets emotional after fights, which is not super often, but does occasionally happen. Like I think he did after the De La Hoya, the Hatton, and the Gotti fights that I remember, he got kind of emotional. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
But
it doesn't excuse his behavior in any way, obviously, but you know, it's just
yeah.
That I don't personally like wish him bad or anything in the future. You know, I hope that maybe the guy does figure it out and stops being an asshole like that, and, you know, can live the rest of his life without any more. But I think it's just so hard to you know, judge the guy on a normal scale when you've basically been, you know, from the time you were a teenager, you've basically been like your family's meal ticket. And as a pretty young man, you know, making just absurd amount of money and in boxing with all of the hangers on and all of the, you know, how many hands in your pocket, And yeah, he lives a gaudy lifestyle and all that stuff, and it's not like, you know, but there's something almost, you know, tragic about that type of shit, you know, because you've seen it
so many times
before, and you just feel like, how can you act like a normal person when this has been your whole life? And, you know, it's getting a sense of morals and right and wrong when money allows you so many advantages in society, and he's had that on top of it as an adult, that it's easy to see how some of the moral fabric, you know, isn't there.
No, yeah, there's no question. And he can't really be judged like a normal human being because the normal laws and regulations and norms and the things that, you know, govern our behavior just aren't really there for him. They don't exist in the same way. That's not to excuse the bad things, but no, that's totally valid.
Only God can judge him.
Only God can judge him.
No, he is mostly a piece of shit. I mean, there's more bad than good, so we'll just leave it at that. But I don't wish any ill for him, and I don't want to see it, you know.
Yeah, I'm comfortable saying he's a total dickhead and just not having to have a huge discussion about it. When people are like, you know, sum up Floyd Mayweather, great fighter, total dickhead. That's it. Great fighter, total dickhead. But, yeah, I mean, we basically ran the gamut of all of the things that we needed to preview and recap and all that type of stuff. There's some more stuff coming on next week. I'm sure we'll be, you know, fully engrossed in that boxing conversation. But thank you once more for listening in. We'll be back. We will be back. In the meantime, tell your family, friends.
We got to get into the Mayweather-Berto fight on CBS.
Yeah, that's right. That is coming up. It's not CBS. It's going to be $9,000. That shit is like $75, $80. That's insane.
What?
Ballsy. But tell everybody
about
our show.
I'll just watch Mosey Mayorga on YouTube then.
Yep, it's up there actually. Watched it yesterday. So tell everybody about our show. And if you enjoy listening, we appreciate that. If you're on Twitter, follow James Foley at jfoley81. See his work at Bad Left Hook and follow me, Patrick Connor, at Twitter at Patrick M. Connor, and visit thefightcity.com to check out my stuff. Finally, like the Top Men Boxing Radio page on Facebook, rate the show on iTunes, all of that good stuff. We love it. Please do. Whore us for it. Whore for us. Pimp us out. We love it. James, I love you.
Whore for us. All right, Adonis Stevenson.
Yeah.
Relax.
All right. Whore for us. Whore. Do it live.
All right,
fuck
man.
It. We'll do it live.
Yeah, do it live. I'm a man. All right.
I'm a man.
Talk to you next week.
For sure, man. All right, everybody. Take it easy.